from deep inside your radio.
Greetings, show listeners. I'm Ralph the Tucking Computer. And before Harry joins us for today's edition of the show, I've been asked by Deep Norwood, Vice President and General Manager of the show, to make the following statement. There have been many news stories in the last few days about Mr. Shearer and another media property. Mr. Shearer will be making no statements, comedic or otherwise, on the show about that situation. Unquote. And speaking for myself, Ralph the Tucking Computer, I just want to say that, given the misinformation in the leaks on this subject from Fox, we're all very lucky that they don't own a cable news channel. And now, hello, and welcome to the show.
Down, I-99. But we will see you.
In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? Yes, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. Karen, she's the silver sun. You best walk her away and watch it shining. Watch her watch the morning come. A silver tear appearing now, I'm crying, ain't I? Gone to Carolina in my mind. There ain't no doubt in no one's mind that love's the finest thing around. Whisper something soft and kind. And hey, babe, the sky's on fire. I'm dying, ain't I? I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? Yes, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? Yes, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. Karen, she's the silver sun. You best walk her away and watch it shining. Watch her watch the morning come. A silver tear appearing now. I'm crying, ain't I? No doubt in no one's mind that love's the finest thing around. Whisper something soft and kind. And hey, babe, the sky's on fire. I'm dying, ain't I? I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. See the sunshine, can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? Yes, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. Dark and silent late last night, I think I might have heard the highway calling. Geese in flight and dogs at bite. Signs, it might be omens, say I'm going, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. With a holy host of others standing around me, still I'm on the dark side of the moon. And it seems like it goes on like this forever. You must forgive me if I'm up and gone to Carolina in my mind. In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine? From behind, yes, I'm gone to Carolina in
Yes, well, if you restart the CD in the middle of the song, it does seem like it's going like this forever. But from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, ladies and gentlemen, home of a team that didn't lose this weekend, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to another edition of the show. This is the edge of no America. This is just smack in the kind of the southeastern middle, the middle of the southeast. And I've been in Durham for much of this weekend. But, you know, Chapel Hill is a lot like Durham, except, as I say, they didn't lose. And that's a big deal around here. They apparently don't make a lot of tobacco. There's a big Chesterfield plant in Durham. And I asked the guy who was driving me over here, do they still make cigarettes there? Because I didn't smell any. And he said, no, it used to smell good, but it was the big cancer factory. Now they don't make them here anymore, apparently, but they still want you to smoke them. What do they do here? Well, ladies and gentlemen, you may have heard about a place called Fallujah this week, site of that horrific Somalia-like, Mogadishu-like incident involving four Americans, not soldiers, ladies and gentlemen, not members of the United States military. We'll get to that in a moment. And there was a lot of anguish at the television news channels as to, as well as at Fox, as to whether to and how much of that footage to show, because it's grisly, it's horrific, it's disgusting. It might enrage Americans. It might demoralize Americans. So some of them showed some. CBS Evening News showed some of it. And CNN showed very little until a day or two later. But more about CNN in a moment. Anyway, the connection between North Carolina and Fallujah. It does sound like an old auto horn, doesn't it? Fallujah. The four men in Fallujah that were killed by whoever those people are. They're either outsiders or, oddly enough, they're insiders. You know, this intelligence game. Yeah, don't get me started. Don't get Colin Powell started. More on that in a moment. But they're employees of a company called Blackwater. That's a nice name. That's a nice image. It's a company that takes former members of Delta Force or other special ops type military and brings them back, private-like. This is a source of some controversy this week because the United States military began complaining that it couldn't keep its Delta Force and Special Forces guys in uniform because the private sector was paying them too much. Anyway, Blackwater, one of the parts of this private sector that's overpaying these guys to get out of the Army and into private security, founded in 1998 by former Navy SEALs. The company has prepared thousands of security personnel to work in hot spots around the world. At its complex in North Carolina, this news story doesn't specify the locale. You know, it's a secure, undisclosed location in North Carolina. It has shooting ranges for high-powered weapons, buildings for simulating hostage rescue missions, and a bunkhouse for trainees. So they're not making tobacco anymore. They're making private security forces here in North Carolina. But it's lovely. Winter will be over any day now, and we're all looking forward to that, ladies and gentlemen. At the top of this week's news, this is a story. There was some reference to it on Meet the Press. Otherwise, I don't think it's been in the news. Maybe it has. Let's see. Let's share, shall we? U.S. officials knew months before September 11th, 2001, that the Al-Qaeda network planned to use aircraft to commit a terrorist attack. This is according to a former FBI translator interviewed in the British newspaper The Independent. This is a anti-war newspaper, just to give you a heads up on where it's coming from. Sybil Edmonds told The Independent that a claim by Condoleezza Rice that there had been no such warnings was, in her words, quote, an outrageous lie, unquote. The former translator with the FBI said she's provided information about her claims to the 9/11 Commission. She said there was general information about the time frame, about methods to be used, but not specifically about how they would be used, and about people being in place and who was ordering these sorts of terror attacks. There were other cities mentioned, maybe major cities with skyscrapers. Okay, that lets off Chapel Hill. Lets off L.A., really. The 33-year-old Turkish-American translator. All right. Said that based on documents she had seen during her time with the FBI after 9/11, it was impossible that U.S. intelligence officials had no forewarning of the attacks. The Independent also reports that the administration had sought to silence Edmonds and had obtained a gag order from a court. So I guess she'll be doing some comedy material. She was one of many language experts who answered appeals for translators in the days gag order, you see, for translators in the days following the attacks, the 9/11 attacks. She was tasked with translating documents and recordings from FBI wiretaps. So she's going back into the material after 9/11 to see what we knew beforehand. From the document, she said it was clear there was sufficient information in spring and summer 2001 to indicate an attack was being planned. President Bush, Edmonds told the Independent, said they had no specific information about 11 September. And that is accurate, but only because he said 11 September. There was, however, general information about the use of airplanes and that an attack was just months away. That's a translator, ladies and gentlemen. But, you know, just a translator, just a Turkish-American translator. On the other hand, we're now attacking our closest ally, you see, because Things have gotten into a rough patch. And when things get into a rough patch, you start the circular firing squad, and the first people you aim at are your closest allies. A U.S. official has publicly accused Britain of failing to take action to eradicate a bumper crop of Afghan opium poppies. The Bush administration took the highly unusual step of sending a senior official to Congress to chastise Britain for dragging its feet in the war on drugs. Well, which war do you want to fight? You know? That really is, it starts coming down to that, doesn't it? We told you heard last week on the broadcast that Britain now says it can't fight another war for 5 years. Apparently, they neglected to mention that included the war on drugs. Robert Charles, the Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement. Hey, see, career day? That's a job to look for. Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement. That's what I want to do. He said Britain was being too squeamish about eradicating poppy fields before Afghan farmers had found an alternative source of income, an alternative crop to grow. The Brits were squeamish because they didn't want the Afghan farmers to, I don't know, shoot them out of anger that they didn't have anything to grow. That's the kind of squeamishness he's talking about. Our point of disagreement, and I put it very directly, says Charles, is that we believe if there is a heroin poppy that needs to be eradicated,
please eradicate me now.
We shouldn't be picking and choosing. We shouldn't be delaying, waiting for an alternative revenue stream to become available. Our priority should not be some kind of misplaced sympathy for someone who will have to do a little bit more work to grow other less lucrative crops, such as wheat or barley. That's called hearts and minds, ladies and gentlemen. It's called making friends among the Afghans. He was appearing before the House Narcotics Subcommittee at a hearing entitled, Afghanistan, Are British Counter-Narcotics Efforts Going Wobbly? We got so much on our plate, don't we? But, look, here's the good news. From Sunday's Washington Post, the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq has accelerated the spread of Osama bin Laden's anti-Americanism among once local Islamic militant movements, increasing danger to the United States as the Al-Qaeda network is becoming less able to mount attacks itself. This is according to senior intelligence officials at the CIA. What do they know? And the State Department. The Sunni Triangle has become a training ground. I'll tell you the rest of this as soon as my computer catches up with me. A training ground for Islamic jihadists who are slipping into Iraq to join former Saddam Hussein loyalists to test themselves against the U.S. and coalition forces. Well, that's the premise, fighting them there. Islamic militant organizations in places such as North Africa and Southeast Asia, nice places, which were previously focused on changing their local country leadership, have been caught by bin Laden's vision and poisoned by it, says a senior intelligence official. They will now look at the U.S., Israel, and Saudis as targets. That's one manifestation of how bin Laden's views are expanding after Iraq. J. Cofer Black, you've heard his name. He's the State Department anti-terrorism coordinator and former head of the CIA's counterterrorism center. Boy, I'd like to see him on 60 Minutes sometime. He gave the same message to a House committee last Thursday, saying bin Laden's virulent anti-American rhetoric has been picked up by a number of Islamic extremist movements which exist around the globe. The U.S. war on terrorism after Iraq may transition from defeating a group to fighting a movement, says Kofor Black. The spread of bin Laden's ideology, he adds, greatly complicates our task and poses a threat in its own right for the foreseeable future. Vague answers to the question, did Iraq make things better or worse? Well, the spread of bin Ladenism. And finally, at the, not quite finally, one more thing after this, but this is cute. This is acute. This is back in the days before we were publicly criticizing our closest ally. This is back in the days when we were making secret pacts with them, ladies and gentlemen. According to another British newspaper, The Observer, President George Bush asked Tony Blair to support the removal of Saddam Hussein at a private White House dinner 9 days after 9/11. According to the former British ambassador to Washington, Christopher Mayer, who was at the dinner, Blair told Bush not to get distracted from the war on terror's initial goal dealing with the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Mayer says Bush replied by saying, I agree with you, Tony. We must deal with this first. But when we've dealt with Afghanistan, we must come back to Iraq. It was clear, Mayer says, that when we did come back to Iraq, it wouldn't be to discuss smarter sanctions. Blair always believed it was unlikely Saddam would be removed from power or give up his weapons of mass destruction without a war. Faced with this prospect of a further war, he adds, Blair said nothing to demur. That's British for disagree. So 9 days after 9/11, President Bush got Tony Blair to agree to a war in Iraq, ladies and gentlemen, even though Blair had said in the middle of 2002 that no decision had been made. And I think the same kind of noises were coming from the Bush administration, but, you know, who was keeping track? And finally, at the top of the week's news, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. This is never too late, Department. It's never too late, ladies and gentlemen, for things like this. Colin Powell has admitted that the evidence he submitted to the United Nations to justify war in Iraq may have been wrong. In February last year, he told the U.N. Security Council Iraq had developed those mobile labs for making biological weapons. On Friday, he conceded that information, quote, appears not to be that solid. Those are quiet, squeaky backing away noises. Appears not to be that solid. Of course, he told the UN it was rock solid. Powell said he hoped the 9/11 Commission would examine whether the intelligence community was justified in backing the claim of the mobile labs. Of course, there were reports of dissidents all the way through that process, but maybe those reports didn't get to Colin Powell. He said the U.S. intelligence officers indicated to me, meaning him, that the information about the mobile labs was reliable, and I made sure it was multi-sourced. Now, if the sources fell apart, we need to find out how we've gotten ourselves in that position, he said. I have had discussions with the CIA about it, he added, without giving further details. This is the first time Powell has acknowledged key evidence that he used to make the case for war may have been wrong. Previously, he's only said that he does not know if he would have backed the invasion had he believed Iraq did not possess nuclear weapons or banned weapons. Sorry, that's enough double negatives for a whole weekend, isn't it? So now, keep in mind, public disclosure of Curveball, our big source, and murmurings up and down the intelligence line that the source was unreliable. Those murmurings just didn't get, ladies and gentlemen, to Colin Powell. You know, what are you supposed to do? The information might not have been that reliable. So sue him.
Don't try to spin on me. said, in the countryside, don't try to do your spin on me.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, welcome to Media Nation. Media Nation, CPR's weekly look into the world of the media and the media of the world. I'm Chris Edwards. This week, public radio circles were enlivened by more than continuing debate over the infrequent burst of unintentional profanity. The long-running host of a long-running CPR program learned this week that he was being replaced. And that host, as it turns out, was me. Milton Getzler reports.
The third floor at 1818 Indiana Avenue Northwest. The jangling nerve center of Continental Public Radio, the nation's third largest source of indirectly sponsored broadcasting without pictures. Of course, if you consider the webcams, there are pictures, but that's another story. Here in the third floor bullpen, reporters scurry to put the finishing touches on broadcasts as diverse as The Sound of Things and Keeping Tabs. But this week's revelation that Ira Zipkin was being named as the new host of CPR's weekly Media Nation broadcast, public radio's third most listened to summary of the week's media news, that revelation rolled through the bullpen like a bowling ball through the gut. Zipkin, who also hosts the Book Bag program, one of public radio's leading literary talk fests, was effusive in his praise for the man he's about to replace.
Chris Edwards was my hero growing up. I mean, you know, I always dreamed that one day I would have his voice. I never dreamed that one day I would have his job. I mean, Chris was the soul, the conscience, the institutional memory of CPR. I think even when you heard a show that he wasn't involved with, somehow, subconsciously, you heard his voice. And, of course, that was a good thing. It told you, without looking, exactly where you were on the dial. I never worked with Chris. We were always broadcasting at different ends of the day.
CPR's longtime special correspondent, Aviva Schlorman. The man who made the decision to replace Chris Edwards was Sandy Van Atter, CPR's vice president for strategic planning.
People ask me all the time, Sandy, what exactly does
strategic planning mean at a radio network? And I'm usually at a loss to give them a thumbnail answer, but here is a perfect example. Taking a perfectly fine show with a serious approach, an intelligent subject, and a rigid format, but doing fine, and just reimagining it with a different host, somebody more edgy, but always, and this is the key, public radio edgy.
Sandy told me he thought the world of the media had more than one or two stories a week that we should cover, and that we should do more in-depth coverage as well. And that combination of greater quantity plus greater depth, it meant that somebody was going to have to talk faster. And I guess for the moment that that somebody is me.
Now, obviously, we don't want to start sounding like commercial radio. I mean, if in 3 years you come back here and we're running 18 spots a half hour and making condescending assumptions about our audience, you can say, Sandy, that's bad strategic planning. But we thought Chris had a wonderful relationship equity with his listeners, and we just wanted to leverage that equity in a more brand-efficient way, always, though, with that public radio respect for the audience. Here, have a mug.
Listen, we're all Chris Edwards loyalists here. I mean, the year we did the Christmas fruitcake tasting when I went into hypoglycemic shock, Chris was the one who gave me CPR on CPR's air. But I certainly agree. We need to keep attracting younger listeners. I mean, we could use hip-hop songs for show themes. That would be wonderful. What will it be like stepping into Chris Edwards' shoes?
Well, that's not what I asked you.
I think it'll take the audience a little while to get used to me, and vice versa. But even though the show is going to be faster, more flexible, more in-depth, and more consistent, I think in time the audience will come to know, as the book bag audience I think has, that although I may be from the next generation, the only thing I've ever pierced is my own pomposity.
Chris Edwards had no statement for this broadcast. Reports indicate he has sought legal advice. Ira Zipkin's tenure as host of Media Nation begins next July after 4 weeks of rehearsal broadcasts. From the CPR bullpen in downtown Washington, I'm Milton Getzler for Media Nation.
Milton Getzler's report was made possible by a grant from the Heselrood Fund for reporting on the politics of public radio. And for this week, that's this week's edition of Media Nation for now. Next time, another look at the media that fill our nation on Media Nation. I'm Chris Edwards. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Life is just a bowl of cherries. Don't make it serious. Life's too mysterious. You work, you save, you worry so. But you can't take your dough when you go, go, go. So keep repeating, it's the berries. The strongest oak must fall, must fall. The sweet things in life to you were just loaned. So how can you lose what you've never owned? Life is just a bowl of cherries. So live and laugh at it all. So how can you lose what you've never owned? Life is just a bowl
cherries, many cherries. So live and laugh,
you know, like
ha 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 ha. Life is just a great big bowl of cherries,
This is Le Show from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Ladies and gentlemen, here's good news. File sharing has no effect on CD sales. You know this story. The record companies have been complaining for years that it's those damned kids with their damn computers who have been stealing those damn songs, and that's why those damn CDs aren't moving out of those damn record stores that are closing up and being replaced by damn Starbucks. This is Harvard Business School Associate Professor Felix Oberholzer, G. That's right. And Professor Coleman Strumpf of the University of North Carolina. Hey, we could have him in here. Let's get Professor Strumpf right over here right now. Get him out of bed. Hustle him out of bed. They based their claim on research carried out during the autumn and winter of 2002. Well, yeah, of course, then. To compare song download volumes with CD album sales. They use data taken directly from the file-sharing networks. Those are the networks the kids use to download songs without paying for them. To calculate a number of genuine downloads made during a 17-week period, they also looked at official U.S. CD sales data, factors such as network congestion, song length, as well as international school and college holidays were taken into consideration. They then used statistical methods, not sure about those, to work out whether the sale of an album declines if it is downloaded more frequently. The result, the professors say, there is no such connection. File sharing has no statistically significant effect on purchases of the average album in our sample. Well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. See, there's the weasel word right there. If you know anything about the music business, you know that most of the stuff they release is far below average. So, moreover, the estimates are of rather modest size when compared to the drastic reduction in sales in the music industry. At most, file sharing can explain a tiny fraction of the decline. Oberholzer, G, and Strumpf estimate it takes 5,000 downloads to reduce album sales by a single copy. And that's a worst-case scenario. U.S. CD sales in 2002 would have fallen by 2 million copies. In fact, they fell by 139 million units between 2000 and 2002. If the professor's analysis is correct, file sharing may have actually limited that decline. Their study suggests that for the top 25% of albums, in terms of sales, one extra copy was sold on average for every 150 downloads. Downloads did tend to impact less popular albums, those with 36,000 sales or less. Overall, they said, the effect is beneficial since the music industry makes most of its money from the most popular albums. So add to the list of people who are lying to us, ladies and gentlemen. No, they're not lying. The record industry wouldn't do that. And they wouldn't steal money from their artists. President Bill Clinton's administration knew Rwanda was being engulfed by genocide in April 1994, but buried the information to justify its inaction, according to classified documents made available for the first time. Senior officials privately used the word genocide within 16 days at the start of the killings, but chose not to do so publicly, because the president had decided not to intervene. This is from a liberal British newspaper. Reports obtained using the Freedom of Information Act show the cabinet and almost certainly the president had been told of a planned final solution to eliminate all Tutsis before the slaughter reached its peak. The president did go to Rwanda to apologize after the massacre and said in explanation,
"We didn't know. We just didn't know."
So It appears to be a widespread phenomenon. You know, maybe it's something in the water in Washington. And now, ladies and gentlemen, time for a copyrighted feature of this broadcast, the Apologies of the Week.
We're so sorry.
You'd think people had better things to do than to write me emails saying, "I love the apologies, but I hate the music." A week after the Illinois House passed a resolution asking for the pardon and forgiveness of members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the sponsoring lawmaker offered a softened version that simply would express an apology for the violence that drove Mormons out of the state in 1846. To the editor, I apologize to all who've been offended, hurt, or outraged by my comments as reported in the Aspen Times. Hi, Aspen, on March 18th. And repeated in two subsequent stories. I'm sensitive to the issues raised by this article, and I understand the seriousness of this matter. I have talked with many Aspenites. If my comments conveyed anything other than the seriousness of this matter, I am deeply sorry. I have met with... What is this about? This is a guy who apparently slammed Aspen's sister city. He's sorry. Utah State Senator Kurt Bramble has formally apologized to nuclear waste activists for what he called an off-the-cuff remark not intended to offend anyone. In a letter to the Healthy Environmental Alliance of Utah, the Provo Republican apologized for saying that the group's acronym, HEAL, stood for Help Educate Anal Liberals. Quote, many of you have expressed concern about my recent public comments regarding your organization, Bramble wrote in a letter Monday. I apologize. Just handling a computer here, ladies and gentlemen. Don't worry about me. Dateline Manila, an official of America's Republican Party, has apologized to the Philippines for mistakenly including it on a list of countries that harbor and aid terrorists, according to President Gloria Arroyo's senior aides. The undiplomatic slip-up drew a sharp response last week and a demand for an apology from Arroyo. She got it. Dateline New Bedford, Bouchard Transportation Company officials pleaded guilty to two environmental crimes, agreed to pay a New England record $10 million fine, and issued a strongly worded apology for their negligence in an oil spill last year that killed at least 480 seabirds and contaminated nearly 80 miles of shoreline, 90 miles of shoreline, in Buzzards Bay. On a related note, we've already done that one. On an unrelated note, then, Dateline Plattsburgh, New York, the case of an Iraqi war protester who dumped manure on the lawn of the Army recruiting office on March 19th has been settled. Michael Bedoyan was originally charged with third-degree tampering. A charge was dropped and a charge of illegal disposal of solid waste was lodged. He pleaded guilty, was fined the minimum of $200, has agreed to write a letter of apology as part of the plea deal, but the justice said his apology had too many political opinions. He must write now another letter of apology without the political opinions in it. Dateline Seoul, an inexperienced South Korean official's joke about North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-il, sparked a serious disruption to reunions of separated families from the two Koreas. South Korea Unification Minister, I'm not going to read his name, issued a public apology to the separated families, putting the blame for the episode on insufficient training of officials dealing with North Koreans. You can't ever overtrain for that. Twice on the Jimmy Kimmel Show, probably not seen in your area. No, it's on ABC. Guest Chris Farney, the guy who fought with Richard Simmons in the story we had last week, said the F word on the ABC telecast. The first one was stopped through the normal delay process. The second one aired on the East Coast. The broadcast of this word violates the standards that we have in place on JKL, network officials said. The missed word was edited out for the West Coast feed. We sincerely apologize to our audience and to our affiliates for the mistake. Hey, do you think the West Coast is more moral than the East Coast? Because every time this happens, the East Coast hears the words and the West Coast doesn't. If the words make for an immoral society, the West Coast should be more moral. Dateline South Bend, Indiana, Paul Horning regrets suggesting that Notre Dame needs to lower its academic standards to, quote, get the black athlete, unquote. I was wrong, he told the Associated Press. What I should have said is for all athletes. It's really tough to get into Notre Dame. There's so many apologies, ladies and gentlemen. Let's end with this one for now. You saw probably that David Letterman had the kid on his show who had yawned behind President Bush during a speech. CNN apologized on the air to Letterman for having reported Tuesday that the White House said his videotape had been altered to put the boy right behind Bush. Darren Kagan first reported on CNN the White House was calling the tape a fake. Kira Phillips on CNN only later cited her sources as they rather than the White House. CNN retracted that report Tuesday night, only after the Letterman had called the White House a bunch of liars. Now, here's what Darren Kagan says on the air. It turns out, due to what we might say a misunderstanding among the folks who are usually so fantastic behind me here in the newsroom, it turns out that was not true. The White House, it turns out, I guess, never did call us about the tape. And we've been looking through our tapes, and apparently we now see no evidence that it was faked. So, Dave, we apologize for the error. I hope that makes things good with us. We apologize. So it's not really clear whether the White House called, what the White House said, or whether CNN really ever knows what it's talking about, ladies and gentlemen. The Apologies of the Week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Please stand by. We'll be right with you. Yeah, I'm back here. Just a little business, ladies and gentlemen. Have to do a little business. You never know about this stuff. But this program turns out to be about radio more than anything else this week. And the big news story in radio this week was the launching of the liberal radio network, Air America. This is a network that purports to do for liberals what, you know, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and all those people do for conservatives. And the the premise is that this network I'm right here. Don't worry about me. This network will energize the liberals and enrage the conservatives. That's the premise. So we had this week the debut of the show. Now, here's the interesting thing. The liberal radio network got on the air by taking over some, you know, as you must, some pre-existing radio stations. And two that they took over were one in New York, of course, and one in Los Angeles. And ladies and gentlemen, the fact of the matter is the one in New York had been a black talk radio station. The one in Los Angeles had been an Hispanic radio station. So, you know, if you're going to make a radio omelet, you got to break some radio eggs. In any case, here was Al Franken with a guest at the end of their conversation on the debut broadcast of Al Franken's show on Air America.
We will see you when you come up here to
New
York.
I'm looking forward to doing your show, and congratulations. It's a great and wonderful development, and I wish you very well.
Thank you, sir. It's an honor.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right.
Okay.
That was Al Gore. Reminded me of something. But it didn't remind me of that. I don't know what it reminded me of, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, it reminded me of this.
Al Gore! From the massively impressive Fairness and Media Building here in the heart of booming Nashville, Tennessee, I'm Al Gore. Welcome to the Gore Room. Lots of requests for our What's the Rush bumper stickers. They're going to go out, I believe, this weekend.
I still prefer Crush Rush.
Now, Al Franken, we don't want to crush him. We just want to crush his ideas.
I want to crush him.
Okay. Coming up this hour on the phone from the campaign trail, my former running mate is one of the bright, bright prospects for 2004, Joe Lieberman. Did you see this, Al? President Bush.
You mean President Idiot?
Hey, be respectful, Al.
He's the man who stole the presidency.
Ha ha ha, down boy. We may have to put you in the lockbox.
Oh, no.
Anywho, President Bush declared last Thursday Reverence for Life Day. Of course, that's code for we're going to try like hell to get you born, and then you're on your own. I did that right, didn't I?
Yeah, pretty good.
Al's been giving me pointers on timing.
Yes, and he's giving me timers on pointing.
What does that mean?
It means we're on radio. We got 2 hours to fill.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. So today, let's see who we're putting in Al's lockbox. That should be whom. Let's try to change that card, okay, Corinna? Got the whole family in the... in the control room today, There's a tipper in there somewhere. She chooses all our bumper music, of course, making sure that there aren't any lyrical lapses.
But they're just instrumental vamps, aren't they?
Yes, but when you hear the vamp, there's an associative reaction, you know. Your brain starts playing the rest of the tune in your head, and you hear those lyrics. So I think she's on the right track there, and no, that is not junk science. Anyway, the lockbox today...
Yeah, this is good.
Today we're putting in the banana industry. Did you see this? For narrowing down the genetic structure of the banana so narrowly, I guess the word would be, that the spread of a single fungal disease threatens to wipe out the entire fruit.
Of the whole banana thing.
I feel like I'm talking to Ed McMahon here. Yes, 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 we would have no bananas, as the old song never did have it.
No.
So for an industry that so short-sightedly endangers the world's supply of dietary potassium into the lockbox. Those are fun. I like those. And that's true about the bananas.
Yeah, we check this stuff out. Mm-hmm. Unlike... some other people you hear on the radio.
Of course, I started out as a newspaper man. That's what we were trained to do. Check out the facts. You know, that's why if you think the media is liberal, you know, that may be why. Because they check the facts and they know that we're right. Now, that's weird in a way because I'll tell you something else. When you run for president, you find out all the media around the country that don't necessarily bother to check the facts.
Hey, but... hey, Senator Lieberman's on the line right now. Hello, Senator.
Hello. Who am I speaking to? Is this Al Franken or Al Gore? You have a company of Al's there.
Senator, this is Al Gore. Senator, I'm going to call you Mr. Vice President.
Well,
welcome to the Gore Room.
Oh, it's great to be a part of something that's been necessary for so long. A sane, rational, but yet entertaining outlet for what I like to call the principled opposition.
Oh, absolutely. And let's get right into it, because we've only got a couple hours. The war in Iraq.
Yes.
Now, does the liberal movement think it's inevitable, and does the liberal movement think it's necessary?
You know, I don't feel as though I speak so much as a part of a movement, more as the spearhead of a campaign, maybe even a mission to bring something back to this country that we've been sorely missing.
Yeah.
By the way, Hadassah and I are so proud that the tipper is in there making this program at least one place on the airwaves where you can take your children when they're old enough.
Well, you know, when the conservatives just crank out the same talking points all day long, I think liberal people and open-minded folks out there just really want to know whether this war might not be a mistake.
Well, Al, you and I may not seem eye to eye on this, but I voted for the resolution in the Senate. I'd do it again, and I pray that I don't have to do it again.
Okay, let's talk about this move the alleged president is making to put a cap on pain and suffering rewards in medical malpractice cases.
Mm-hmm.
So if I get this straight, Joe, the price is about to go down for committing a possibly disastrous medical mal-something.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't that mean more screw-ups by our admittedly overworked physicians?
Well, Al, the insurance industry was getting socked with these ridiculous $1 billion, $2 billion damage verdicts by these runaway juries who like to see themselves on the news. Mm-hmm. They did the only thing they could do in the situation, raise the cost of malpractice insurance for everybody. I think the administration is on the right track here.
Well, they're not on the left track, that's for sure.
What do you think, Joe? Should I put Al in the lockbox?
Oh, don't get me started.
No, don't get me started.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like Air America. Who knew? Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at this same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan. Around the world through the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America on WBCQ, the planet 7.4 and 5 megahertz. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive at harryshearer.com and at kcrw.com. And now available as a free download at audible.com/LeShow. And it'd be just like me learning to run this board if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Alrighty. Thank you very much. Uh-huh. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at innerworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. Le Show Playlists, often available at the newly refurbished harryshearer.com. My thanks to all the gang here at WUNC-FM for helping to make today's Le Show possible. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Production and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.